Yeah, I think we're live. I think. June 4th, 2022. Yeah, welcome. Coming at you here from Belgrade, Serbia. On the general subject of the war in Ukraine. Not a lot to report. It'll be things that develop, like, of course, day by day for people who are really want to know the movement of every unit and the status of every village. But in general, this kind of encirclement stuff is developing. As you can see, war takes a minute. Anyway, today we have... I know a lot of people always ask me to get back to this subject because of my approach to it and because of the way I treat the question. It's actually a lot of different questions. Tartaria and chronology is our general subject. And actually, these are like two different subjects that have been kind of merged together in like the realm of like popular conspiracy theories. And that makes it, it adds a layer of problem because you have to kind of start to deconstruct that stuff. And what you don't want to do is, you know, pile on to like a never ending train of errors. So the Tartaria stuff is related, but kind of is a separate and arose independently. But you can't really understand them without understanding each other. The chronology issue actually is frightening because it doesn't merely suggest, oh, there was also like this country called Tartary or Grand Tartary. That's not, you know, actually a lot of countries are missing or relabeled, or our conceptions of spatial or cultural spheres are all, how to say, discombobulated. So it's actually much more of a problem. It's actually much deeper. In many ways, Tartaria is almost just like a footnote. Like, yeah, oh, by the way. But in describing one or the other problem, you get back to similar issues relating to the way in the knowledge production industry. So we can get into looking at it from being critical of the manufacture of knowledge. Like, how does modernity regulate the industrial manufacturing of knowledge? What are the processes and rules of that? And what are the natural existing processes in knowledge formation in a culture that would lead to vastly incorrect sense of the history of the immediate preceding, I don't know, say 1,000 years or 2,000 years. That's really what you're talking about. So what's fascinating about this is that at the root of it, and I think what you're going to really, you know, dig in as you get comfortable and start to think about this question or these questions, it doesn't require some grand conspiracy to see that there are big problems in the way we think about history. It doesn't require a grand conspiracy. a number of years ago, I worked on, just as a hobby, a way of looking at the way that power and the pursuit of power and wealth in and of themselves within a given historical, you know, time frame can distort any number of things, right? So we don't need to have a grand conspiracy or one grand conspiracy. There could have been a number, any series of crises where you have like perfect storm, natural rising phenomenon, and so forth. What are we saying about what? Okay, so let's not get ahead of ourselves. I guess the main idea is that much of the history of the last roughly 3,800 years, okay, so going back to about 1600 to 1800 BC, the very beginning of, you might say, recorded or semi-recorded Western history, if you say Western history as the central focus of history. So we have like from the beginning, you know, I don't want to abuse this word, okay, but a Eurocentric perspective on history. This is actually going to figure in prominently, okay, in terms of the length of history. So you have a lot of normal reasons why you would have had this disruption. So effectively, what is proposed, and I'm not saying that this is absolutely it, but just sort of how the people, I'm introducing you to these ideas, right? And how people have basically put this together is that we have probably, you know, 1,200 years of history, roughly, where we know, like, people's names and roughly, you know, roughly, and there's some enough records of, like, this was the king, or this was the republic, and these were the senators, or this was the so-and-so, or these are the ones that are named, this was the prince, this guy became the king, this was his uncle, this was the duke, like, these kind of family trees of nobility is one aspect. To understand, so we're talking, first of all, about a Eurocentric perspective. Secondly, this is called the Western tradition. Thirdly, the Western tradition was forged out of the shadows of a larger tradition, okay, which suffered tremendous shocks, okay, as you might say, the Roman Empire kind of split into East and West. And I'm not talking about events in the 4th, 5th, or 7th, 8th centuries, or I'm talking about really, you know, 11th, 12th, 13th century divisions in East and West Roman Empire. And to say it like that, I know already we're already getting into deep water, because, you know, we're talking about the 11th, 12th, 13th century, and we just said Western Roman Empire, which is not supposed to, you know, technically exist after the, let's say, 4th or 5th century AD, maybe the 470s or something in the Western, in the West. Now, so it's kind of difficult. We have to kind of start to say things like the alleged something century or the so-called something century. Right. And we're just going to keep it clear. So we're going to try to keep our descriptors clear. It's a super exciting subject. So now, if you had basically you have 1,200 years of history, beginning with events like you might have like the In reality, what was happening 1,200 years ago in Western Europe was the Carolingian Renaissance, right? So in other words, the neo or re-Rome, Greco-Romanization, right? This is the official narrative. And this is where we start poking holes in it, by the way, just to kind of understand, okay? you have in Western France, okay, or in France, in Western Europe, Frankish entity, okay, and you go from the Merovingian kings into the Carolingian, and the Carolingian period is marked by this, they call it a renaissance, right, of Greco-Romanization, all right? Now, just as an aside, and maybe it's not worth mentioning, but I think it's sufficient to mention that when Renaissance scholars of Italy discovered these, what would have been at the time, okay, 700-year-old parchment, right? They believe that from the Carolingian Renaissance, who they wrote in Greek and Latin, primarily Latin, and the religious stuff in Greek. Okay. Charlemagne spoke, with their version of French at the time, their archaic French, but he also spoke German, Latin, and Greek. Okay, so this Carolingian Renaissance was mistaken. All of the literature and whatever documents, mostly record keeping. And by the way, a lot of history evolves out of record keeping. Okay, and we'll get to that shortly. Now, the Renaissance scholars believe that this was ancient Latin. They believe that this was, the original Latin that justified them calling the experience that they were having in the 1400s, 1500s, for them thinking of this, we call it the Renaissance, but they were already thinking of it in those terms, as historical periods become more self-aware or more calling themselves the thing, self-labeling historical periods. The Renaissance saw itself, okay, in the beginning, simply as natural developments, okay? But by a century and a half into the Renaissance is when you get the self-narrative that this is actually the second time this happened, just like this, okay? We might note the lack of intermediary evolutionary stages predating neoclassical architecture. They should go through the classical stage. In other words, they shouldn't begin developing at a point right above and beyond the highest level of antiquity, sculpture, architecture, etc. Right? It would have to redevelop maybe an intermediary stage right before the highest point, because they're relearning lost knowledge. I mean, you're talking about, there's no chain of custody of this knowledge where it's being passed down like through trades or something, right? Ostensibly, right? We're trying to make sense of the actual story as we're being told, right? The actual official story. So things like this. So you really don't have the Renaissance. This is really just the first time that it happened. And then that just basically pushes the period of like ancient Greece and Rome to the early medieval period or the Dark Ages. So whatever what they're hiding and what they're saying, no, there's just nothing happening. The Dark Ages, actually, if you look at the pinnacle of like the development of neoclassical, and then, Rococo and Baroque, you go into the 1600s. Uh-huh. And then all of this, you can see, if you start looking with these eyes, you start seeing that that is the Roman style, okay? When you look at the Persian imperial style from the 1500s, 1600s, etc., you might first think, oh, a lot of Persians spent time in Italy, okay? No, right? This was also the period of the pinnacle, the cultural pinnacle of in the same. This was also the Persian Renaissance happening, not in the 8th or 9th century, as like the Persian-led Islamic Renaissance, actually. Actually, this you're talking about the same period, about 500 years ago. This is when you see this explosion. And the lack of intermediary forms, I mean, you do have intermediary forms, right? But you have to go back to early antiquity, right? So then you start to just look at all of the architectural remnants. You start to see that medieval castles, we're not talking about ones, you know, what they call medieval. Sometimes they talk about ones built like in the 1500s or 1600s. That would not be what we're talking about. Castles built anywhere, you know, from like the 800s through the 1200s or something like this would be seen as Roman forts, as what gets called Roman forts. And also what gets called Roman forts are indistinguishable from ruins of medieval castles. So there's just a lot of details like this that kind of work into the equation. Yeah. But when you look at the main issue just of on that little segue of Italian history itself, you start to see, since we mentioned the Romans, that there was the reality of the feudal system of Europe. Okay, there are many ways of drawing maps. Let's kind of back up a little bit. There's many ways of drawing maps. Okay, in the Westphalian system of the 17th century and onwards, okay, we tend to draw maps. So from like the middle, late 1600s onwards, we tend to the geopolitical maps of the world are the countries, okay, based upon an organization of some type of, you would assume even like a centralized authority or something like this, right? Like a central government, okay? Whereas the maps that we see of the feudal world that are given to us, of the feudal world, okay, are misrepresentative because they tend to show every duchy, every principality, every kingdom, okay, when the idea of an emperor still existed. And by the time that we're looking at sort of like the declining period of the Roman Empire in the West, you know, maybe like in the 1200s or something like this, 1100s, you have like the lay investiture crisis, and the Holy Roman Empire, you know, of the Germans and Northern Italy, you know, are fighting over the significance of selecting the Pope or not, right? But the either the emperor or the pope really serves that role. But when you get into the tradition of 18th and 19th century literature on the Roman Empire, right, and then the entire spectacle of the tradition of art from the late 19th century, from the pre-Raphaelite Brotherhood, okay, there it's from this tradition of the late 19th century of pre-Raphaelite Brotherhood art that you begin to crystallize in your mind very distinct aesthetic and other ornamental costume, etc., differences between antiquity and medieval periods. Also, it was in this period that the ideological construct of like of the medieval period versus antiquity period were all made very distinct. Okay, whereas even literature in the 19th century and 18th century continually and consistently, I should say, consistently uses the Roman titles that you would associate maybe like with the, you know, second century, first century, let's say first century BC or 50 BC, at the, you know, ostensibly, right? Allegedly 50 BC when Rome is controlling, you know, all of France, okay? Most of France, where you, you know, with Caesar's conquests in Gaul, in France. You know, when you realize, you know, that period, right, was not happening, that this was actually talking about the various civil wars that occurred within the medieval period, that was already from, let's say, from around the year 1000 was going to be, you know, pre-Christian, like millennialists, or what's the word? Messianic. And then after 1100-1200, then you have like the Christians. So then, but the idea of the Christ had been a unifying principle as a messianic principle prior to that. And then so there's a lot of deconstructions that are done of the problems with history. Now, I know it sounds, and for some, it sounds like a crackpot idea, but just keep in mind that from the very beginning, it's not like people have been going along for, you know, 2,000 years. Dating things in terms of like Anno Domini or like AD, generally speaking, documents were dated in terms of the reigning government, like the year of the king so-and-so, which makes all of those datings related or dependent. Okay. Now, while there's a lot of medieval documentation, okay, that is placed generally, give or take a few centuries, you know, in the right geography, I mean, right, time spatiality, the geography of space of time. Okay. In the chronology, there are, the way that time and space is manipulated with antiquity documentation, a whole other set of rules apply. So the rules that are used to determine the authenticity of medieval documentation of historical events of the medieval period, okay, when we're talking about primary source documents, by the way, is different from antiquity. Antiquity relies very little on primary source documents because it is said that many of these primary source documents simply stopped, you know, existing, that they deteriorated, they were old, there were fires. But what is of particular interest here is that by and large, most of these antiquity documents, fortunately during the Renaissance, were copied by very reliable, you know, trustworthy people with no connection to, you know, fraud or crime or anything like that, or scams, or making history for money, like creating history for money. Fortunately, none of these people were, oh, just kidding, they were. All of them, all the people involved in creating Italian history are compromised. And the system that arose from the, out of the Renaissance and through the so-called Enlightenment, 1700s and so forth, the issues that arise time and time again are that the individuals who are tasked with determining which historical documents are, you know, authentic and which ones are forgeries, okay, are themselves the ones who have a established record of making forgeries or of passing forgeries off. It turns out that probably a lot of, you know, I don't know if it's most or a lot, but a lot of these are judgment calls that don't involve, it's not like you're doing the analysis of like ink, where was the ink sourced from? And then this would have been likely, because that's probabilities. In person could have a pen with ink from somewhere from far away because it was a gift. You see, there's just too many problems with, well, probably this is this because here's the material evidence. Well, sure, prosecutors make careers playing games like that and putting people in jail because they're supposed to make cases to the jury in a prosecutorial, you know, reference, but they're just trying to put people in jail. We don't, with history, we don't need to say that we know something or something is probable if we don't know it. When you talk about human beings, you know, it's hard to say what's probable. When you find, for example, okay, if you find somebody buried with a lot of belongings and you date those belongings to 5000 BC, you might be in error to date that person to 5000 BC because they could have been buried with their belongings that were ancient. Likewise, there could be a museum, right, of antiquities, right, that was buried, you know, in the antiquity period, and the things that were found there are actually of an older period. So unless the materials themselves are made out of organic material, like mud or clay or something like this, parchment, things, you know, like this, carbon-based material, can you use these carbon dating methods, which are also problematic? So when people usually are introduced to this idea, their first kind of initial responses, if they're aware of, you know, these things, what about, you know, radiocarbon dating and these different systems? These have, of course, have been calibrated and improved in some ways, but like in any field, you have selective enforcement issues, and how they look at the results and how they qualify them and quantify them is an adjudicated process. It's not like the thing just, it's not like you give a sample and the machine spits out the number of the year. Okay. It's like there's delegation that goes on here. And you're going to include in that process of dating using, you know, radiocarbon methods, your premises, which you're sure are correct, when in fact these premises are wrong. Also, just with a lot of these, radiocarbon methods, the rate of contamination can be as low as 1 or 5%. What am I talking about? Well, let's say you have a parchment and you're trying to date the parchment, but let's say it got leaked upon by water and it had a little bit of mud and stuff in it, whatever. Now, not like all over the parchment. So then now your sample is going to come up. That document might come up to be much newer or more recent than it might actually be. Or vice versa, if it was contaminated with like older mud. It just, the whole thing is dumb. With the dependent, so that's actually most of radiocarbon dating relies upon dependent dating methods, because they'll take another thing that they're sure is right from the same region and be like, well, this is how we should calibrate how we interpret results, right? Because beta decay is actually not, even though when they originally developed the system, there was assumptions about the rate of decay that was universal, and when they're not universal, and then later They recognize that they're not universal, but they have to be adjusted. So the level of subjectivity and calibrating your results based upon, you know, setting those variables to given quantities are based upon their beliefs or their paradigm going into it. So a lot of there's problems in that system. And now what normally gets introduced, and it seems like I'm not talking about, you know, some vast conspiracy, and I'm not talking about some conspiracy. There have been many conspiracies, and there are reasons why this happened, but generally speaking, power elites are changing in time, and they have some lineages because of the concentration of capital and the tendency for people to inherit wealth. Okay. And between those tendencies, between capital concentration and inheritance, like, you can see how there's possibility, there's space for conspiracy, like multi-generational conspiracies of elites. And there are things they conspire on, but then there are just common sense things that they can agree to on a day-to-day or year-to-year basis that are basically conspiracies, but they're just based on the situation in play. So one of the questions is that, you know, why would the ruling class today perpetuate it's the wrong year? Like, what does that purpose, does that serve? And that's just the wrong question. Okay, we first have to establish whether the dating systems that we're using are wrong, the system for arriving the year that we're at, basically based on, is it how many years since the life of Christ? Because we're saying that all these events, right, we're saying that all these events from that are said to be, you know, between 2,000 years ago to 36 to 3,800 years ago are all events that took place from, you know, to varying degrees of documentation that we can assess, maybe just kind of trying to see where it fits in from around the 11th century and prior. So you would have maybe when you have a like kind of a visualization of ancient Greece, okay, of antiquity Greece, in reality that would have been happening simultaneous to the medieval period. But if it started a little sooner, then you're just talking about the 700s or 800s AD. So the earliest, like, antiquity Greece, when you have like that standard visualization of what antiquity Greece looks like, by the way, that visualization comes from the Pre-Raphaelite Brotherhood art movement of the late 19th century. Okay. Now, I know that a lot of these things I'm mentioning in kind of non-sequential order, right? Because it's all related, and I want you to just understand in this introduction to the subject, when we've actually talked about this two or three times before, people have a hard time finding them in the drives for some reason. I don't remember. They're not always titled. Sometimes we talk about the subject, and it looks like it's just a war report or about something else, so... or a public question session. So when you look on the drive, there might be, you know, you just have to actually listen to the episodes to find the ones. And let me know where I talk about this in before. But really, in a real way, on this subject, while there have been conspiracies, it's not necessary to think in terms of finding like the reason for the conspiracy. Okay. As far as I can tell, okay, the crisis began around the time of the middle 15th century, and now we get into games. Okay. The Ottomans, this is going to be complicated. Oh, God. Okay. There's an entity which we call in history the Ottomans, okay? But the reference to calling them Ottomans doesn't seem to arise until around the 1600s. And prior to that, they're called the Turks. But we know that Ottomans and Turks are not the same thing. Turks is a reference to the visible or linguistic ethnicity, the cultural or linguistic, same thing, sort of, you know, the presentation of any number of groups of people that were horseback riding with who shot arrows, okay? The idea of Turks as an army on foot is a strange idea, and in fact is not really put forward as how Ottomans did things, which is strange. Relying on Ghulam and later Janissary of foreign populations that were kind of put into, that were pressed into this imperial service. And now we mentioned the issue of the Ottomans because the event that took place was the 1453 loss or victory of Constantinople. It was taken by the entity now referred to as the Ottomans. We'll just say Ottomans, but you get that that there's a lot of problems in this, okay? From an entity that we call the Byzantines. The main issue, of course, is that the Ottomans at this time didn't call themselves Ottomans, and the Byzantines at this time didn't call themselves Byzantines. They both called themselves either Romans or the proper rulers of the Romans, despite the fact that in the Turkish nationalist tradition and romantic historical creation period, they rely very heavily on the Turkish ethnicity and bona fides of Mehmet II, who was the Ottoman sultan who conquered Constantinople in 1453. Okay. His claim to Constantinople was no different than any other of the civil wars, between, was it Kouzentzakis and the Palaiologos, or the, intermarrying and feuds between Palaiologos and Komnenos. Any number of the Roman families of the medieval period, okay, of the ruling families of Rome, of the Roman Empire of the medieval period, okay, which is erroneously referred to in contemporary studies as the Byzantine Empire, as this began to be the tradition out of French historiography developing out of the late 1600s, was to refer to the medieval Roman power as the Byzantines. There had been a denial that the entity in the East was Roman of any character at all. In fact, Western institutions did not begin to, as a matter of category, as a matter of department, institutionally, study the medieval Roman Empire, the Empire of the medieval Romans in the East, the lands of Greece and what is today Turkey and etc., the Balkans, until the 1970s. For centuries, they had been referred to, either ignored. There was people in the 1800s, a Westerner learned in history could speak about Catherine the Great and the Russians and can talk about the Ottomans. but there was a deafening silence on the Byzantines, which were then incorrectly called Byzantines, but also not talked about until the 1970s. And things that were Byzantine were often called Ottoman, because they had been in the areas that were Byzantine, eventually became Ottoman. Many things that are called Ottoman are oftentimes more like Russian or Tartar. But anyhow, there are so many problems in these historical narratives, right? And we only introduce the layers of problems that we to understand the problems in the categories, okay? Because it's actually the logical outcome of all of these incorrect categories. When you assemble all these incorrect categories together, you arrive at this incorrect, inflated view of history. Okay, you could take the Russian history, for example, of the last 100 years, and you would have some books talk about pamphlets and things like this. Some books rely more textually heavily on the word Bolsheviks. Some talk about the communists. You might have a book just talking about Stalinism, etc. Okay. Now, if you were to fast forward, go into the future 1,000 years, okay, and these books are crumbling and there's problems, okay, they didn't use the same dating system that you use, so now you're trying to figure out when all this happened, okay? You might see 100-year or 50-year history of Russia in the early 20th century, and you might expand that out like 2 or 3 or 4 centuries, you know, 2, 3 centuries. You might be like, well, the Bolshevik period was first, and that was led by Lenin. And then there was like this communist trend that was like another century later, and that was something else. And then the Marxist Leninists are different from the communists, are different from the Bolsheviks. Different books use different words. You have all these different remains of books left, and you start to construct a history that makes room for all of the facts that you think you know. So then you extend that out so that all of these words that are actually synonyms, okay, get their own place in history, and that itself has an inflating tendency on history, doesn't it? Right? Like, you might have a first name and a middle name, and then in the future, people might assume that when that's written, they're saying you and your father. So then that extends, like, the number of time and people and years involved out by double. You see? There's a lot of ways that history is misinterpreted, and we could go at length. I mean, first of all, you didn't even have the development of the printing press in a way that, you know, is functional until the development of the Gutenberg machine with variable letters. And there were some iterations in some decades before that were very similar, okay, but we say Gutenberg as the definitive thing. And prior to that, language reproduction was tedious. I mean, it had been, again, for a century leading up to Gutenberg, there's very similar inventions, okay? But when you're talking about in the 1300s, 1200s, this is all being written by hand. Or you have stamps or whatever, and actually the systems kept changing, and that's actually the problem, because knowledge production in the medieval period and prior to that was being done by a lot of these monks that lived in these monasteries, and their job literally like all day was to reproduce these texts. The problem would arise when you look at differences in calligraphy styles or different notes that you might make in one original, and then as it gets reproduced, you get errors. And in calligraphy, you have, especially in old calligraphy, you have some very identical letters. And oftentimes they're grouped together in the alphabet. Sometimes they're not. But strangely, and this, I know this may sound weird, but L, M, N, and P are often written very similarly in calligraphy styles. L, M, N, and P are often written very similarly in calligraphy styles. I know that's weird, but in fact, it's true. Other problems arise in the letter S, Z, F as in Frank, and T as in Tom. Those can actually all come out very identical. Anyway, so you can see why some countries call the Ottomans the Osmans, other call them the Ottomans. The name Hoffman or Offman, like O-F-F-M-A-N, are all references to the same. You're talking about the same thing. Hussars, Cossacks, Ottomans, Ottomans, it's all the same. They're all cognates. It's all the same word. And but many different militaries historically have used Cossacks, you know, Hussars, etc., as the main of the host. So the Ottoman Empire is an interesting thing because you could be being attacked by Russians and think that you're being attacked by Ottomans, and you wouldn't know the difference looking at them either at the time, by and large. Also, on the subject, well, we talked about this before, how at the Uffizi Gallery in Italy, how they have the changes to that were made in art, right? So in the 17th century, there was a movement to change the realism style portrait art of the Italian nobility that had been the nobility from like the 15th and of the 15th and 16th centuries, or the of the 16th and 17th centuries. A lot of that portrait art was changed in the 18th and 19th centuries. And a lot of bearded people were changed with shaved faces. So there's a lot of, for some reason, there were different trends in Italy at the time, and there were shaved faces and bearded faces. But for a lot of reasons in Italy, the nobility were indistinguishable from what you would call how a Ottoman looks like in a, you know, portrait, like in a 17th century portrait of an Ottoman. The Italian ruling class looked the same. They wore these big onion bulb turbans and stuff and had these big beards. So it's really weird when they made these revisions 100 to 200 years later that they put these little tiny little red felt caps on them and shaved their faces. It made them look really weird too. But these are the ways that, you know, these ideological changes, like there were big changes, for example, in 19th and 18th century Spain, right? Big changes in how they tell their own story of themselves. This idea in Spain of this fight of Christianity versus Islam, okay, would have been news to the people involved in that fight at the time, okay? Because in Spain, these weren't how the divisions were really understood. And you had Muslims fighting for Christian kingdoms, and you had Christian kings fighting for Muslim kings and so forth. It was more just normal feudalism with a divided religious sphere, but that was just like one more dimension of the chessboard between a lot of families, and some would be Muslims and some would be Christians, like in the same family. And that actually kind of gets more to the point. So in 19th century Spain, during the Romantic period, this is when a lot of history gets destroyed big time, is in the 19th century. So we're going to talk about the phases right now real fast. So you have the first wave of destroying history, or misinterpreting history, however you want to put it, is different for different reasons. That was like in the 16th century and early 17th century. Then in the 19th century, in the Spring of Nations, you have this trend called Romantic idealism that creates all of the ideas about the origins of nations that we have today. And it affects, it's you had, you know, Garibaldi in Italy in the 19th century with Italian nationalism. It was the age of nationalism, okay? Which means that you're developing these myths and these narratives, and some are based in truths, of course, too. Don't misunderstand what I'm saying. I'm not saying everything's a social construct, therefore false, okay? These social constructs bear a certain reality and reflect things in a distorted way or in a way that is most practical for the interests at the time to present themselves, to present their history, okay? And that's the origin of the crisis itself, okay? But in the issue of, for example, Spain, you can see that you can see that the food of Spain that was eaten in Spain, for example, until certain regional foods began to be promoted as national foods. But from the conquistadors, you can see the conquistadors that their food was identical to Lebanese food and Turkish food or Mediterranean food, because you can see that in Mexican food today. And besides the ingredients, Mexican food should not be confused with, you know, whatever the pre-Columbian indigenous people ate. Mexican food is brought by the conquistadors. Okay. So there's very strange things that develop anyway in a number of directions. When you look at the crisis of the loss of Constantinople, this is when you start to see this strong impetus on the part of the Roman Empire of the West to start to create a longer chain of history of the Roman Empire being in Italy. Okay. But by the sort of like the counter narrative that we're talking about, places like the city of Rome in the way we think of it today wasn't established until early 13th, late 12th century, early 13th century. You have the city of Rome in Italy being established in the way we think of it. And it was made out of bricks and things like that. There's a lot of problems in the, you know, city of Rome itself. Many books have been written by many different authors about the subject that I'm talking about. This tradition of criticizing the narrative of the chronology that we have is as old as the contemporary chronology itself, okay? It seems to be the case that as early as the actual 5th century AD, as early as the, it seems that in terms of the confusion, okay, that as early as the actual 5th century AD, okay, which was only 500 or 600 years ago, okay, they began to believe that they were actually in the 1500th year. But this wasn't a dominant view until the early 1600s. And the two people that were tasked with sort of making sense out of that and putting a bunch of conflicting histories together, that this project really didn't get going until the later part of the Italian Renaissance, or the Italian Renaissance around the 1580s and 1590s. As the Renaissance is already moving north. You're already getting the Northern Renaissance, right? By the early 1600s, right? The Renaissance in Germany, the Renaissance in Northern France, right? That's where you get all these 17th century Central and Western Northern European philosophers, mathematicians, the foundation of the academies, like all of this stuff just starts picking up steam in the past 400 or 500 years. And a lot of the things that might be older than that, maybe like the city of Bern as a medieval city, you start to see that these are, well, this is the Helvetic Confederation. You know, that Switzerland is the Helvetic Confederation, Confederatia Helvetica, and that is, as it was an entity today, as it was an entity in the 1800s, etc., that's just a carryover from the Roman period. I mean, they call their main in Bern, like, the you can see these things were built from the 1300s through the 1600s, and that it was built, and that it is a Roman or independent, you know, but in the Roman Latinate style and entitling methods. I have a small collection of 19th century history books, and I have a particularly great one on the history of Germany, for example, that was written in the 1880s. And it gives all of the titles of all of the figures from the Holy Roman Empire, and then going all the way through the 1600s and 1700s and onwards, continues to use the Roman title system for everyone. This idea that we use medieval title system for the medieval period and the Roman title system for the antiquity period is a sort of forced thing, because historians up until relatively recently correctly used the Roman system to describe titles held by medieval figures in the medieval nobilities and onwards after post-medieval through the 1600s and so forth, 1700s even. Now, keep in mind that people like Isaac Newton and others were, when history was introduced this way, that now we're in the year 1600 instead of 600. Bear in mind that the average person on the street, you know, didn't know where they were relative to geography, okay, and didn't know what century they were in relative to other centuries. The idea of literacy and everyone having that, you could ask anyone on the street, like, what year are we in, and that they would tell you, and that they should be right, is like only an expectation that we develop with the rise of public education and generalized education, with the rise of literacy in the 1800s and 1900s. So you know, just walking around and asking people in 1650 whether or not it is 1650, they wouldn't know what you're even on about. You know, only people who were literate and who were writing would typically have that. I mean, the watchmaker and clock and people who are literate in urban centers would know, but you still had majority populations living in the as farmers, as in agriculture, as peasants. So when you look about the rise of modernity, what you're also looking at is a conversation about who we are and what all of this is a broadening conversation. It's a conversation that more and more layers of society can participate in with the rise of literacy. The problem is that we're coming into a field like history that is an inherited tradition from elite institutions, that's based upon a specific narrative which has a particular ideological view from a certain time and place that represents their class, that represents their sense of status, that represents their narrative about who they have a right to rule over and how long they've been doing it. Now, there is a lot of people who have been questioning this. We talked about Isaac Newton. So this is basically what happened, was that while generally speaking in what we call the 1500s, there was a view that they were in the 1500s, okay? That was among the people who would be involved in the creation of culture. So when I say common view in the 1500s, that people were in the 1500s as a common view among people with any business thinking about what year you're in. You see? That's not an almanac question for farmers per se, right? It's not a thing that an uneducated person, and most people were uneducated, would have a concern about. So we're talking about a ideological movement or a number of notions, postulates, conventional ideas, or hunches that became more popularized among the literate classes. And rather than viewing the crucifixion of Christ and those historical events as something which had just occurred in the past 400 or 500 years, which, by the way, the printing press is not invented until the Gutenberg machine, right? So prior to that, there's not as many historical documents, consequently. There's not as many copies of things, consequently. And things are written for different reasons. Whether something is going to be published, rather, there are different considerations given the scarcity of potential to publish in high volume. So, of course, the Bible was very important as a cultural artifact, as what was viewed as truth in this time and place. And then moving forward with the printing press, you can now produce all these other documents, right? There are basically, you have the first school, you have, because the people who were involved in trying to do this and who had presented these things, one character is named Petravius or Petravis, and the other is named Joseph Scaliger or Scaliger. And Joseph Scaliger, a lot of these people have been involved in different hoaxes and claims to, you know, solving mathematical or geometric puzzles and things that were currency among the educated class at the time. They having these things that were like these round robin, which we may get back into later in talking about other problems with bibliogenesis and the origins of texts, okay, is that scholars would write these round robins. And they would attach, everyone would attach their papers and comments together, and they would bind them and then send them forward to the next scholar who might be, you know, 500 kilometers away in another part of Europe. Okay. But this is a much smaller conversation, right? Happening among fewer people, right? At a time about 400 years ago, when we really concretized this idea that this is the 1600s. And Scaliger and Petravis helped to concretize that, and one of the big jobs was to orient, no pun intended, the histories of the East and the histories of the Near East, and Egypt and, you know, Baghdad, Mesopotamia, into the European timeline. And so consequently, a lot of things, well, let's say like with Antony and Cleopatra, which very well easily were events relating to the dynastic intrigues of, let's say, the Crusades, right? Maybe the Second Crusade or something like this, is thrown way back in history, right? When any other iteration of the story of Antony and Cleopatra, you would know that you were probably talking about like a French or Italian prince and a Greek or Armenian queen. Hyksos, so it'd be like Armenian or Greek, right? And during the period of the of a romantic tragedy in the period of the Crusades. Now, there was a French scholar also at the time named Jean Arduin, Johannes Arduinus. This was a 17th century French classicist. Okay, studied theology and had access to the Jesuits and had applied to run with them and learned a lot of things along the way about the games and the problems that were happening. But he took a lot of things, okay? Now, what you have to understand is that there at the time that you have, like people looking at the works of Pliny the Elder, Gaius Plinius Secundus, yeah, the Roman naturalist and author, naval and army commander of the early Roman Empire. Okay. He is supposed to have written the Encyclopedia Naturalis Historia, right? But when you actually look, when people look at these, at, for example, this, what we have, and it's admittedly so, is a Renaissance quote-unquote reproduction, like quote-unquote Naissance, quote-unquote production. So when you hear Renaissance reproduction, which is most of what we have of antiquity history, are Renaissance reproductions. So just like, so this is what, right? So just like the architecture is supposed to be a reproduction or a post-mythical, highly, you know, detailed, highly, or extra ornamentalized, I don't know if you would say it's like antiquity on steroids or antiquity on MDMA, but it's certainly a sight to behold. It's beautiful. But the idea that this came out of nowhere, because that's actually what they say officially, is that the Renaissance comes really out of nowhere, okay? That just by discovering these old books and stuff and by finding these ruins of statues, that somehow this magically bestows upon the population the ability to create them without the tradition of, you know, mentor and journeyman, and without the traditions of how to, the technique being passed down. Yeah. There's big problems in this thinking. But it was John Arduin who pointed out that there was problems with Pliny the Elder. Okay. That this was like maybe like a forgery. And this is a person who's an expert on Pliny the Elder, because his work, like his job, like what he was paid to do, was to edit. Was to edit the work of Pliny the Elder for the institution, the official institution that he was employed by, for a series of books that is today considered authoritative. The, oh gosh, what was it? Dauphin series. It was like a royal approved French seal of approval, okay, of document, of authenticity, right? Just like my piano has the seals from the king on it. The Dauphin series has the French seal and is considered correct. The reason that he would need to work to edit ancient history is because in the time between its discovery or rediscovery 100 or 150 years prior and the present, many of the editions going around contained references or things that his job was to determine that these are editions, even though it was all written like in the same style and or printed in the same volume without distinction, that refers to more recent historical figures. You see the problem? So for the French to authorize the publication of this at a time, keep in mind that you have the Inquisition going on in book burnings, was so that natural history didn't contain references to events and people that otherwise people knew, you know, oh yeah, that was 200 years ago. Why would this 1420, we know these characters, we know what happened in 1350. But of course, they would have thought of it as 350 or something like this. Many until, you know, probably around 1500 or 1600. People in 1350, whose job it was to know, right? Again, most people, not your business, doesn't matter, go back to work. But this is an anarcho-communist commune. They have... a problem going back, like we said, to the loss of Constantinople. And what appears to have happened is that the original location of Rome was moved from Constantinople to the newly named settlement of Rome in Italy, and that they created a longer history of the Roman Empire in Italy, or maybe the length of it is not older. I don't know. The thing is that, just to keep in mind, okay, just what's being said and what's not being said in this idea. What's not being said is that the universe was created 1,000 years ago and human beings were not doing anything prior, or that all civilization and all these cities and everything just popped up 1,200 years ago. That's not what's being said. Okay, we can continue to assume, you know, thousands of years of development going back or whatever, and maybe if certain places and things are misdated, we get the idea. So maybe if the, you know, particular ruins in Egypt or Indus River Valley civilization or whatever are dated wrong, or if the real things from that period are under further layers of sedimentation or whatever, or were in different locations or in the ocean or whatever. Certainly people were doing things 5,000 years ago, 10,000 years ago, etc. That's not what's being said. Certainly people 3,000 years ago, let's be more precise, certainly people 3,000 years ago ate stuff, wore things, spoke languages, had culture, produced evidence of that culture, etc. Okay. And certainly at times, maybe that stuff gets found. Okay. Perhaps it is correctly placed back then. Sometimes it is not correctly placed when it happened. It might be placed farther back. Maybe it's placed more recently for all these reasons that we talked about in the culture, in the academic, in the adjudicated process called carbon dating. And so what is being said is that there's a certain history of Europe that is fairly orderly in give or take big details, but, you know, and very narrative driven. But just in terms of the chronology, you know, the meaning and the narrative is all whatever. But the chronology and kind of like these people were kind of like named this and stuff. Okay. Although it makes big errors when it deletes people and places them back in time, but the ideas and the general idea of things going back 1,000 years is not entirely wrong. It's just that they took the story of the past 1,000 to 1,200 years and they tripled it backwards into two separate phantom histories. So they created a 1,000-year block using the stories of the past 1,000 years. They created 3,000 years of history. So sometimes these stories repeat, for example, okay? And then, or they take two narratives and they assign, instead of that culture having to decide which narrative to decide that they're going to identify their people with, they can have both narratives. What do we mean by that? Well, were Italians conquered by the Romans, or are they the Romans? Okay, that's kind of weird, right? Because Rome is the city, and then the Romans conquered all of Italy. Okay. If you're an Italian today, and you love being Italian, you might love the Romans, but you might be the descendant of people who Romans conquered in some other part of Italy. Most probably you are. Right? Okay. Likewise, the Hungarians, right, are simultaneously the Tartar invaders or Turkic invaders of the land today called Hungary, and they're simultaneously defended as Hungarians, right, in the double phantom history that defended the land of Hungary from the Mongols. But they are the fucking Mongols, which is a point of pride, in my opinion. That's a badge of honor, if you understand what I'm saying, where we are going to go with this. We get later into Tartaria. We're just introducing the problem. We're not going to be able to conclude our subject today, obviously. Now, looking at the first problems in history from the 17th century. So now, bear in mind that you have Scaliger and Petreus officializing this idea that this is now the year 1600. This is when this happened, basically, around 1600, 1620. Okay. This is how we're going to manage this invention that we've had for the past century and so of the printing press, because otherwise it's a crisis. Because knowledge is power, and to have power, to be in power, means to regulate what is considered truth and what is considered fiction. That is a power in and of itself towards its own ipso facto ends. It is power in and of itself. What is power? The truth. Truth is power in and of itself. So holding back truth is to conserve it and to retain it towards yourself. is to conserve and retain power to yourself. It's most likely that most information that we have is false, and on either on the practical level, or even if it works in practice, the underlying theory of how it works, like say lift on planes, the underlying theory is still contested. We build airplanes. How airplanes work is a continued state of debate between engineers or physicists, engineers, practical engineers. You can look that up. Like how lift works is unknown. I mean, it's officially debated. They could both be wrong, you know. So just because we use something doesn't mean that we're entitled to tell the story about why it works, like with electricity or any number of things, as an aside. Okay. But so Arduin, shows, I mean, we know this anyway, okay? The people whose job it is to determine when a document is a forgery are experts in forgery for reasons that are impolite. Because sometimes they get asked to create forgeries that would be believed. And using their reputation and their honor as people on the side of truth, who have testified in as expert witnesses for things that we will discuss either today or at a later time. Expert witnesses in trials over fights over property, which extended the history of Italy by itself by an order of several magnitude. With Arduin, he was a very serious person. This is not a quack or a fringe figure, okay? He had been appointed by the church to supervise a collection of royal declarations for history. That was eventually published in 1715, okay? But he was accused of suppressing things that they wanted included, but that he knew were just too fake to, like, even pass muster, not because he was allergic to fakes, but because he was a competent, outer/creator of fakes who lived in an ecosystem of experts. There were rules on how to make fakes. Like if you want the document to have been from 1200, then you use this type of ink and this type of paper, and then it should look this way because that's how they had testified in court. And that's how they had established the method of dating papers. But the church, he was in conflict actually with the Jesuits already openly at this time, and the Jesuits had a problem with his submission on the 1710 or thereabouts, eventually published in 1715, if I'm not mistaken. Okay. They didn't like, he was including things that they said were false, religious, historical, and suppressing things that they wanted to be known as the truth. But he seems to me more like a rebel and a whistleblower, and also, however, that he's also protecting his own hide because just because these Jesuits are insisting on including these documents doesn't mean that they passed muster. Maybe they had a second rate, but still, very, very good falsifier, forgerer, create these documents. And then when Arduin looked at him, he's like, if I give these the green light, then I'm going to lose, you know, street cred. Like my colleagues are not going to even consider me competent. Well, eventually they all declared him to be incompetent anyway, because he finally apparently snaps. And he basically says that all of the ancient classics of Greece and Rome were spurious, that they were all created by monks around the time of the 13th century, except in the cases of the satires and epistles of Horace and the Georgics of Virgil. Now, some aspects of them, like there's parts of them that he thinks are legitimate, but we'll get to the real potential dates of those later, okay? Or fictional. In fact, he denied the authenticity of most works of art that were considered ancient, noting that there are certain styles that had developed in the late 16th and early 17th century art towards the direction of chiaroscuro and other techniques that we see in the works of Rembrandt and others, that were claimed to be antiquity frescoes. They were not identical to 17th century realism, classical realism, but they are identical to the immediate precursor, using the same, or the students' works, or how studies would look, like sketches or, you know, pencil, charcoal, or other mediums that were in the same style, though. And it's known, you know, that wouldn't pass muster from let's say Rembrandt, because you'd be like, oh no, this way of drawing the thing and or how to do that is like, you know, it was my mentor who developed that, so it's not possible that this is from, you know, 43 BC. This would arise again with this problem and this actual contradiction would arise again with the when they uncovered the remains of the volcano. Which one was that? And in Italy, and that was claimed that it was, you know, been under ashes for several thousand years, and it turns out that the event took place like in the early 1600s. Was it Mount Vesuvius? So as you can see, I approach the question with a little bit more rigor and look at some of the history and the problems involved in that, okay? But Spinoza and others had been identifying fake dates from church writings or medieval documents this was going on. It was a debate, you know, and people knew what the methods were. People understood what was going on, okay? And I guess today what we'll do then, to round out, because we started about 90 minutes ago, we'll go 30 minutes and we'll get into just the problem in Italy. We'll just, because we start talk a lot about Italy, and we'll just round it out. The problem of Italy's going to keep coming back, by the way, because you have Julius Caesar, you have the city of Rome, you have a lot of things where Italy, and then obviously the genesis of the crisis. Okay, I mean, all of this, of course, raises epistemological or epistemic problems. It arises ontological problems, a theory of knowledge, the concept of being, of existence itself, because we have to deconstruct our false sense of how sacrosanct ancient history or medieval history is, or ancient history as a subject, that you find that it falls under the same, that the impulses to distort history, to distort what was happening, even when it was happening, okay, had an imprint on the future. So even when historical events were correctly dated, it could be a very bad misrepresentation of the events from the time, but that fit an agenda at the time that has been incorporated into the modern agenda. And it's hard to unwind that. And there's reasons not to unwind that, because there's no impetus to roll the truth out, because the truth in itself is power, and those in power would like to concentrate that power and to keep it from you, and truth is another bit of power. But this lie was born out of a perceived defeat. And it very much involves at its roots how the most powerful, I guess you would say, location where different wealthy families, powerful and wealthy families for different reasons. I mean, you had the mercantile, the Venetians, the Genoese, the Florentines, but then you had the military, you had the church. I mean, Italy, very powerful, but I'm not saying the country. Yeah, the country, but again, this is before the Westphalian nation states. So we're just saying in this place called Italy, the origin of a lot of these errors about history take place. Okay. The problem of historical chronology is one which until recently garnered a little attention. But as we've been saying, with the development of the information revolution through the internet, broader segments of humanity were given access to academic source and primary source material. And so for the first time, larger segments of the population can go onto archive.org and get into and look at scans themselves of books. And the best books to look at are from the 1600s. Because that's when all of this stuff was still fresh. It was debated, and yet there's a lot of books that you can find because the printing press had been pumping these out for a little bit now. Which, again, just like the internet today is like the central fight of information war, the printing press was the central fight of information war 500 years ago. Book burnings, that's all related, right? So because of this, new questions have been raised which could not have been raised by past generations of scholars due to the authoritarian structure of contemporary academia. This structure tends to preempt the possibility of the development of paradigm shifting approaches. The political and anti-critical nature of the modern and postmodern peer review process essentially disallows for entire revisions of the present body of knowledge, as we talk about a lot. The people who are wrong about this, the dominant paradigm, has the right to be wrong. They should be wrong still at this point. We're at a natural point in the paradigm shift in relationship to how we're understanding even the problems in chronology and where we stand in a paradigm shift in relationship to other questions vis-a-vis Great Awakening, vis-a-vis world events. This growing cumulative and exponentially growing shift vis-a-vis Great Awakening and people's access to information is all connected to this paradigm shift. So the fact that in the paradigm that we are in the process of, revolutionizing or transcending, take your pick, it makes sense that they would have the old view that this is the year 2022 and this is what happened. And that's the idea that we are in the year 2022 is a 17th century idea. So as we talk, that's why we refer to Kuhn and structure of scientific revolution so much, because it relates so much to the Great Awakening. Okay. So prior to the first years of this century, it was almost impossible to talk about this stuff without a widespread reception. Okay. Now, we'll do Italy on this, and we'll give some background also to, we started giving background on Arduin. So I think what I'll do is I'll go from Arduin to Motozov, and then from Motozov to Fomenko, and that'll be like 5 or 10 minutes, and then we'll come back and just finish on Italy. Okay. All right, good enough. So Arduin was not the only one to criticize the chronology when it was sort of introduced, and how they tried to tie in the histories of Egypt, Armenia, China, etc., Ottomans. All that was a shit show. It was called out as such when it happened. None of these things made sense. Events that were known to have happened only 500 or 600 years ago had been rebranded as events from 2,500 years before. Everyone was aware of it who was literate at the time, but whether you could, you know, call this out was a, you know, question of practicality in your career and your future and things like this. This was sort of like a new normal that had been reset upon people, and speaking out against it was a problem, even though the people involved, like Scaliger, were later exposed to have lied about a number of other things, or presented false proofs. I think he claimed to have squared the circle or something like that. Okay. So then what happened is you have in Russia, in the late 19th, early 20th century, you have a historian named Morozov, and he uncovers this stuff. He gets into things. This is a period of tumult in Russia, and now Russia is entering into World War I, and anything goes. So he's getting access to things. There's obviously fighting. There's sometimes villages or cities under attack, and there's documents flying around, and he's getting his hands on things from Russian sources and things that Russian had in important places during this revolutionary period. Things are getting turned around. He gets into documents, and he finds some of this Arduin stuff, but he finds other stuff too. From what he can tell, in the year that was being called like 1920, if I recall correctly, in the year, because he's alive at that time, 100 years ago, and in the year that's being called 1920, he realizes, I mean, in his view, that they're only like in 1420 or something like this. Anyway, so he writes a multi-volume book centering around these problems. He does try to date the year that we're in from when he can date the birth of Christ, the life of Christ, and looking at the biblical literature at the time, and, you know, in the explanations of the year and the position of the stars, and, you know, that the church had used in the dating and things like this. Now, by the time he completes his work, you know, now the Russian Revolution has happened, the Bolsheviks are in power, the government is led by Lenin, and if I recall correctly, my Russian history is sometimes a little spotty, but the head of the, literature, of the Department of, like, Reviewing Literature, at the time that's going to be published, because you have like censorship. It's like the communists are in power. I mean, there was a lot of censorship under the Tsar. Don't get me wrong. The Tsar was censoring. The Bolsheviks started publishing stuff that the Tsar censored and started probably censoring stuff that the Tsar had published, right? And in that, they look at this Motozov submits his text, and the head of who's going to review that is named Lunacharsky. And but it's of particular interest because of like what a crazy or, you know, eye-catching idea that we're only living like in the 14 or something hundreds. Lenin had heard about the work and asked Lunacharsky about it, and Lunacharsky said, yeah, it was very interesting, but it was rubbish. Mozdorov hears that the submission has been denied by Lunacharsky. He jumps on a horse, gets to the train station, all the way to St. Petersburg, where I think Lunacharsky, that provisional government, was operating out of St. Petersburg for his department at the time. And he shows Lunacharsky the receipts behind his claims. A lot of that relied upon the position of planets and the basically the star map at the time, and showing, you know, and in other errors, basically goes through his evidence. Lunacharsky flips out, realizes that Mozdorov has a point, immediately writes Lenin and says, another mistake, we have to publish this. So the book, I think it's called Christ, is published in Russia, I think between somewhere between 1920 and 22 or 23. Anyway, but this was not very well known about. Then in the 1970s, another Russian, now he is a doctor of mathematics at Moscow State University, and was the chair of the Moscow State University Department mathematics of cosmology, like the mathematics of the, like basically the of rotation of planets and things like this. And he has a colleague in the States at that time named Dr. Robert Newton, no relation, centuries apart. And Dr. Robert Newton is proposing a solution to a problem that seems crazy. And the problem is that if we go based upon the historical history that we consensus history, there are periods in which the eclipses don't occur like as they should. In other words, like the moon would have to be speeding up or slowing down at variable times throughout this, only in a certain period of this group of centuries. And so now Dr. Robert Newton is proposing crazy things like, here are the reasons that the moon would have slowed down or sped up. And Dr. Fomenko, who's in the same field, says, isn't it more likely that medieval historians made an error in what year we're in, you know, as opposed to say that the fucking moon is speeding up and slowing down? Doesn't that kind of make more sense? Yeah? So this is the line that he began to approach, and he produced his own kind of excuse me. He produced his own series of books on connecting these things. Many points I think are well made. Others he might make an error. I mean, but there are some big errors, but the overall idea is very interesting. I mean, there's not big errors that cancel out the foundational, like they're not deal breaking errors. They're just big errors in terms of, well, conclusions or deductions that are not necessarily have to be made. But he's not involved in making all of those because he teams up with some people in the production of some of these books. But But yes, the histories of Western Europe were effectively extended farther back in time. And there are both ideological reasons and natural, meaning non-conspiratorial. I mean, not natural in terms of doesn't involve human beings, but I mean, it's still socially created. But, you know, you can have a lot of corruption towards practical ends at the local level produce such distortions. Also, you could just have the paradigm and the thinking that people are in about how they see themselves, and just these unquestioned foundations of what the history of the people is, and then try to, you know, rationalize and right size every emergent piece of data into this premise that Rome was founded. And again, was Rome founded in 1800 BC, or 1600 BC, or was it founded in 800 BC? Was it Rome and Remus? Were they Wolf brothers, or was it the Trojan Marine Corps? The invasion of the Trojan Marine Corps after the loss of Troja, when they escaped by boats and then sailed, when the Trojans founded Rome at the end of the Trojan War. But if the Trojan War is actually the, I don't know, 1204 event in the conquest of, or sacking of Constantinople in 1204, what was that, the Third or Fourth Crusade? And then that was the Trojan War. So it explains the East-West, you know, Roman Empire things in terms of medieval terms. To think about a Roman Empire in the West, but then you look at a medieval map of Europe and you see all the different kingdoms and stuff, those are not mutually exclusive ideas, because within empires you have many kings. So you're just looking at a map that's showing things a certain way. It takes for granted. It's by the 1600s or something like this, like the expression the Christian world increasingly replaced Roman world or Roman Empire. That's basically the linguistic change that was made. That's all. So Fomenko then does that book. So that's sort of like, but there's other books too. And the titles, many people have written on this, and there's been lots of internet activity around the subject. And there's been some very big discoveries made and ideas added to this. I think that helps to introduce the idea with Italy. And of course we talk about Tartaria, and we're setting up to kind of explain it. But with Italy, because so much of the origin of the false history is from Italy, right? And it's a subject we have to keep attacking. There's right now, I mean, I can tell you just from what we have said so far, we've only hit on maybe a fraction of 1% of the material. Of course, details are immense to what we already have said, but what we already have said is a minuscule fraction of either the data or the argument of how to reconstruct the data in a way. Okay. And what I basically do is I employ a lot of Occam's razor, you know, this idea, they say in the Latin, pluralitas non exponeda sine necessitate, entities should not be unnecessarily multiplied. And that's the same approach to history. we don't need to multiply history out, right? So even though it's already an accepted problem within consensus history that there exists practically no primary source materials from classical antiquity, right? We have a knowledge production industry filled with people whose job it is to cite with vigor the works of supposed antiquity historians, right? Now, one of the major figures of classical antiquity historiography is Herodotus. Herodotus is an important, and one thing to keep in mind that kind of starts to give away as people conceptually begin to unravel the problem here is that when you think of ancient history in the Western tradition, you think of the Greco-Roman world. But then when you, and then you, oh yes, they documented this, they documented that, they documented this, we have all of it. Turns out we don't have it. Turns out it's from the Renaissance, and they are reproductions by someone who is an expert in forgeries, reproductions, and authentication of originals. And we introduced at the top of the hour the origin of the misidentification of originals as being the style of Latin. There's a style of Latin used in the Carolingian Renaissance of France from the 9th century, which for over 100 or 200 years was the working model by which all ancient Latin, by which any document would be have been determined to be have written in ancient Latin. Okay, now even though sometime later it was discovered, by sometime I mean 150 something years, by 1700-1800 the consensus shifted such that these Carolingian antiquities were actually from the Carolingians, and that, you know, the way that the history, the official history, got pieced together, okay, even though in reality the Carolingians were the Franco-Roman entity, like the Carolingians were that antiquity Franco-Roman entity of the Roman conquest and collaboration and, you know, pseudo-conquest, pseudo-colonization, you know, soft power and the, you know, the process of the Franks, the Gauls, you know, internalizing Latin, Greco-Roman culture and kind of viewing that as superior. That this they had it right, that they didn't have it wrong. The problem is that everything else is wrong. So they were actually right that this is ancient Latin because they actually implicitly admit so. Why? Because they're talking about unrelated people in the field of history, but the consensus view shifted. I say they, but we're not talking about real people. We're talking they, the institution. The consensus view shifted sometime by 1800-1900 that it was the Carolingian Renaissance that had produced these ancient Latin texts, therefore making those ancient Latin texts not very ancient and not Roman at all. In fact, French, written in the Latin language. Right. Of course, the issue being that what we would propose instead is that the ancient Roman period was actually taking place in that time. Okay? That it even preceded the establishment of the city of Rome. Well, that makes sense because for most of this time, anyway, the capital of power in the Italian peninsula had been out of Ravenna in the north, just south of Verona. But anything Ven, like Verona, Venice, Ravenna, those are all related. The Ven, like Veneti, the Vendi or the Veneti, they're like a Italo-Slavic or Slavic. They're like related to probably related to Croats and Serbs. Brenner, right, who sacked Rome with his army from Ravenna. So you have this in the history. And now we can get a little into the details. Now, we said Herodotus was a problem, and it's typical in mainstream historiography to differentiate the method of Herodotus, let's say, from that of Thucydides, right? Because Thucydides is considered to be more precise and more linear in his exploration of the related material. Nevertheless, Herodotus is upheld as an example of a certain type of history, of the type of history that we think of in terms of where we put meaning to things, of social history, and also people in history and personalities in some way. Is a certain type of history, and more importantly, the events which Herodotus describes are used in relative terms. In other words, he never puts a date to anything. Everything is dependent on the rule of this king or the events of some war, like 5 years before this war, 10 years after the birth of this king, things like this, okay? So he often gets called the greatest liar in history by others because of the ebb and flow, or the in the process of bibliogenesis, in the construction of history, then this is an ongoing trend, okay? Later historians in the 19th and 20th century find irreconcilable problems in some of the foundational work of these people, or of the rationale of the how they arrived at their decisions, okay, without doing the logical thing, which is to revise those things. But nevertheless, that's the paradigm that we're in right now. So this is all very characteristic, as Kuhn would explain, is all very characteristic of paradigms in transition, because the official view is straddling two positions. It does understand a lot of the problems in the way that even Thucydides' history is, and how it's been manicured or maintained or curated, as we explained, with the falling out that Jean Ardouin had with the ecclesiastical authorities over their desires to introduce forgeries that even a master forgerer couldn't tolerate, you see. Now, here's the issue with Herodotus. Herodotus, a single page manuscript from the, I think, the start of the 9th century AD, like from 810 dated roughly, is all that can be independently dated and verified as a work titled Herodotus. Now, when I say independently dated and saying that it's from the beginning of the 800s or the 9th century AD, I mean, of course, what we call that time. I mean, of course, you know, in relationship to where we are right now. So 1100 years before. Typically, people imagine Herodotus as being, you know, more than 2000 years ago, of course, you see. But we're placing our attention first with Herodotus as a kind of getting to brass tacks, right? Now, and we're going to get into these forgers, because Herodotus, as we were saying, none of these people were known to the 11th century as ancient people, because the concept of the ancient and the concept of an ancient history of which we are this continuation of in the present is an idea that arose in the late 1400s through the middle 1500s, and it was at the foundation of the rise of the Renaissance and of humanism, and laid the foundation for the Enlightenment, of which many of the ideas of our age derive their origin. And the person who discovered Herodotus, we said these were all Renaissance discoveries, okay? was a lower noble named Lorenzo Valla. Okay, now Lorenzo Valla is the one who discovers Herodotus. Now, okay, prior there is Herodotus, a single page from the 9th century. It's only a few paragraphs. That's it. That's the original. That's Herodotus. Okay. There are then 8 additional single page works that have been, until recently, I would say, I mean, there's even debates now. What I'm talking about is real. Like, this is right. There are debates. There are mainstream historians saying the Dark Ages didn't happen, trying to knock out 300-400 years of history right there. There are mainstream historians in Germany right now, very mainstream, very credible. They're arguing, they're debating right now, writing peer-reviewed stuff, and variations of the theme that probably the year we're in is 1700 right now, because the Dark Ages didn't happen. Now, they're right, the Dark Ages didn't happen, but they just need to apply that criteria to all the other centuries surrounding it. But you can see that the chips and the cracks. So Lorenzo Valla, okay, this is where it becomes weird, okay? There's the extended Herodotus, which is 8 or 9 pages, right? And these are considered part of this original work, but they're from the 11th or 12th centuries. And we know that because they're written in a type of fragments or box prose style. That was the style that was written of all writings from around, you know, the 10th century AD, give or take a few hundred years, right? But the problem is that it's already been long established that this style, this box style, even Plato, there's stuff in the box style. This was used by the number of tellers of heroic legends as well. That style of writing, I can cite, for example, Diodorus, Diodorus from about 50 BC, even though it's alleged 50 BC, it's written in the identical box style of the box prose style of the medieval period. Strabo allegedly works from 15 AD. This is the foundation of what you think is that of ancient antiquity. Herodotus, Thucydides, Diodorus, Strabo, Photius was around and writing in the style, in this box style, but was in 900 AD. Like Photius' history, I think the relevant we're talking about was written around 897 AD. That is today, like the idea that Photius, despite his name and all that, despite his subject matter, is agreed, the mainstream view is that he was in the 10th century AD, that he lived and wrote at that time. You see? Now, the original script, so we're talking about Photius, right? The original script of the Agatharchides, okay, often this has 3 widely varying readings or different fragment styles, okay? But this is instructive because Photius, who lived in 900 AD, like, in other words, when I say 900 AD, I mean, you know, 1,100 years, only 1,100 years before us, not 2,000 years ago, okay? That's the same age as the oldest manuscript of Herodotus, okay? But the different, these widely varying readings of the original of the alleged original script of Agatharchides has been, as you know, the changes are very great between those. Okay, there were also additional significant embellishments that were replete with his own comments of Agatharchides' words when compared to the older versions of the same written by ascribed to Diodorus and Strabo. Okay. Now, of course, none of the three agree and indeed contain many differences. And this is related to the Renaissance humanist dilemma in verifying the authenticity of Diodorus and Strabo as well. So in other words, they got Photius right. They placed him at the right place in history. So people in 1500, like, look, let's be real. 600 years ago was a long time ago. Okay. But for you, from the present, the past 300 to 400 years of that 600 years has been very well documented. Even though there's lots of lies for like political things, like you have a strong idea, the French Revolution, 1789, American Revolution, 1776, like this event, 1612, like you have a fairly good idea, setting aside the narrative and the politics crap, but maybe these events occurred, you have a pretty good idea for like of history for more than half or even two-thirds of that last 600 years. Maybe a lot of that 600 years. Some would say, you know, with maybe a false sense of certainty that they have a very strong idea 600 years ago was the year, you know, 1422. This person was born, blah, 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 blah. And maybe that's accurate, okay? Now, imagine now that you're in the year 1500 or 1600 and you're trying to put all this stuff together. 600 years ago or 700 years ago is a long ass time before the printing press. There was not daily newspapers. It's a lot of clouds and mystery. It's obscured. You see? It's veiled in darkness. Okay? Just the whole, from the point of view of the Renaissance and the printing press, which comes right away, they don't really know. 600 years back, I mean, if something very important happened 600 years ago, then maybe something is more important if it happened 2,000 years ago. And we're going to get into the details of these distortions in just a minute. Now, so we were taking, for example, the original script of Agatharchides, right? And looking at how the stylistic changes occur over what is allegedly 900 years. Okay. Photius seems to stand as the only independently verified being from 900 AD. Historical source for works associated with Photius, okay? Now, maybe that 900, maybe the year 900 actually took place like around 800 or we don't know, or 1000. There are some other distortions that occur later on. I don't want to like belabor or confuse or get into details, but there may have been some issues in the last 300 years as well, or 400 years that could put us off by another century. Just incidentally. Now, many of the works of, for example, Photius' stuff was found in modern-day central Turkey. So the Photius, discovering Photius was another order altogether. Okay, and most of these things were discovered by the English when they weren't part of, so Photius has stuff that kind of is mirrors, like with some of this literature, we're talking about Agatharchides, okay? Why in the hell would this person in 900 be involved in a literary conversation, adding to this or interacting with the works of Strabo, of Diodorus, you see? When there isn't a broader culture to support that, there isn't an understanding why in, I guess you, by the modern parlance, you would say that this was a Byzantine Anatolia at the time, today called Turkey. This was like in central Anatolia. Yeah, so even a little farther, to the east than the Lydian tradition of Anatolia would be. Talk about the Lydian cultural tradition based on the Lydian period of antiquity. It would be very hard, right, to substantiate Photius being in antiquity Anatolia, so far east of Lydia, of the Lydian civilization, which was a Greek type, you could say a Greek type, or you know, whatever. They were not Greek. I think Lydians spoke Greek. Maybe that's your definition of Greek. They also had another language as well, but they're considered a, you know, part of that family. And but Photius, we can say, probably was in the year that we call like 900, which means in reality it could have been BC, right? If we have Christ around 1100, 1200, around there, it's actually like 1000 or 1100, I think, is where it's supposed, where it was meant to be. That's another conversation by the older priestly caste, the different readings of the ages of the Plato's great year and the precession of the equinox. When the age is in its zenith, when the Messiah comes during the age, does the Messiah come at the beginning of the age or at the zenith of the age, right? That's an old debate that even goes back to the Samaria or Babylon. So many of these works originate from modern day Turkey, okay, while others originate from Egypt. But it was in the 19th century, if these things were not part of the Renaissance, okay, and if they were discovered later, usually they were sold to the English by the Ottomans as antiquities, okay. There was a period of weakness, of relative weakness in the Ottoman Empire, in some parts in the early 20th century before World War I, in the 19th century. And you had this tradition in England of going around, you had like spelunkers and the Royal Amateur Societies made trips to Turkey to uncover these various artifacts, which are claimed to be evidence of Hellenic classical antiquity. Okay, this is at the same time that you have this, you know, this romanticism about the past, whether it's pagan or primal European, like in the ideas of the work of Wagner, right? With Percival and the Arthurian legend, you have the rise of the pre-Raphaelite art movement, which gives everyone their ideas of what chivalry looks like, what the feudal nobility dressed like, what their events were like, what their castles were like. This inspired the works of Tolkien. They inspired that whole genre. They inspired many, many contemporaries of the time into fantasy. but they're based in the Pre-Raphaelite Brotherhood art movement. You know, people know that that would kind of evolve into the marketing and like product art movement. I know that's kind of sad or weird, but it went from like Pre-Raphaelite Brotherhood right into advertising packaging. Well, it went right into Art Nouveau, didn't it? Right. And then from Art Nouveau into Art Deco. Yeah. By the 1930s, 20s, 30s, you have Deco. 20s, you still have Art Nouveau. And a lot of the early Art Nouveau stuff is really just development of Pre-Raphaelite Brotherhood era stuff from the late 19th century. And this whole idea of like everyone walking around wearing white togas with these white like architecture with the pillars everywhere. Like this is the English and German construct that was built in the 19th century in continuation of the same modus operandi that was behind the Italians three centuries before in their creation of the mythology of ancient Rome. All of this is to what in fact actually seems to have occurred is that civilization has been moving from east to west, and that various iterations of Persians and similar have been becoming Greeks and Romans in more recent centuries. I mean, to summarize very greatly, Persians have been transforming into Greeks and Romans over a shorter period of more recent time. Armenians have become the Germans and the French, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, you can go on and on. You can, you know, the Slavs have become Germans as well. Many of the, you know, the Franks, the Germans, many of these people groups filled in later on. Remember, the warming period didn't hit Europe until the, whatever, the 10th to 12th century. What was it? The medieval warming period. So you would have had more colder conditions and not as much friendly to widespread agriculture until around 1,000 years ago in a lot of Europe, I think, right? But these members of these various English royal amateur societies would make trips to Turkey to uncover these different, you know, artifacts, as we were discussing, that were the evidence of this classical antiquity of the Greeks. Now, without delving, you know, into the subject too much here, as we keep saying, these need to be understood within the context of the Great Game and the English Empire's war against the Ottoman Empire. And a large part of this is the soft power aspect. We talk a lot about this here, and that was a cultural war. In many cases, artifacts of the so-called Byzantine Empire, actually it was just the medieval empire of the Romans, and its eastern successor states like the Seljuk of Rome, who are like evolved into the Ottomans, that these were appropriated by the English. They were stripped of their more recent Greco-Anatolian or Hyksos Egyptian heritage, and they were placed in a distant quasi-mythical past, dated vaguely in a world spanning as far back as we've been saying, like the 15th to 18th centuries BC, and as recently as the 4th century BC, like the so-called 4th century BC, okay? So it was the English who then superimposed over this their own trajectory themselves as a rising power, because we're talking about the rise of the British Empire, right? By this time, you see, the English superimposed over the Italian Renaissance mythology that they created, right? And they superimpose over this their own trajectory as being the true inheritor and progeny of this newly constructed Western heritage. It's this idea called the Western heritage. So besides this like single passage of Herodotus that can be independently dated to around the year 900 AD, there's a nearly convincing secondary set are the Oxyrhynchitis papyri, I forgot to mention, from Egypt, which are dependently dated. Now, these are not forgeries, but are nevertheless suspect artifacts. And this is why I say this. The main reason why dependently dated artifacts must be placed aside as suspects is that the dependent factors which date them are also seriously called into question. One of the primary methods used to dependently date the Oxyrhynchitis papyri, right, which were found around the close of the 19th century, and why these were dated as belonging to the 3rd through 5th centuries AD, are their similarity to other Oxyrhynchitis papyri found at the same time, which those contain deuterocanonical texts, right? And because of what we think of those dating period of when the biblical events occurred, right? These are then dependently dated to the same period. Because within that Oxyrhynchitis, remember like the Dead Sea Scroll finding? Okay. Within the Oxyrhynchitis papyri, with like Gnostic and deuterocanonical and, you know, books, right? We have dated those. So in these finds also are other works of literature. Okay. Now, at face value, prima facie, using more consistently the very same declared methods of dependent dating utilized by the consensus historiographers, right, these ostensible works of Herodotus should be considered from the first several centuries of Christianity, right? We should. So in other words, this idea that there's an ancient period and there were like this, we have this idea of Greeks and Romans, and we have this Jesus Christ character running around 2,000 years ago. These, yes, were indeed contemporary events. They were just significantly more recent. Taking all other conventional dating norms as dogma, right, would probably place some of these events maybe in the 5th century AD instead of the 5th century BC, with some of the, in terms of how far back you might start saying we have some of these historical stories of ancient history of antiquity might be as old as 1500 years ago and be, you know, the true part about it is that they happened first or earliest in the history. You see, but yet these have been placed instead in the 5th century BC. So we're not talking about ancient antiquity. Now we're talking about what's considered to be antiquity, right? So from typically, in my understanding, and maybe I'm dating myself, and I'm not a spring chicken, but it used to be that, you know, the antiquity period was roughly from the 5th century BC until around the 5th century AD. It's a very late age for antiquity, I know, about 5th century AD or around the Justinian period. Around the Justinian period, right? The Justinian period is the end of the Roman Empire. And therefore, they say, or of a different type, or there was a rebirth, the different things happened, but they were constantly reconquesting and revitalizing the Roman Empire. But the 5th century events happened in Rome. Now, what we are often presented as the work of Herodotus, right, is not the single independently dated page title Herodotus, right, nor are we presented the several other Egyptian pages which seem to date from the 12th century AD, but are officially dated from the 4th century AD. Okay. As a 4th century AD reproduction of a BC work. You see, what started happening in this process of dating based upon style is that even though in reality, what you have are a lot of different styles and a lot of different inks and a lot of different parchments that are used in different locations based upon availability or based upon relevance to the region or to the style or other maybe even more subjective factors like preference and convention in that time and place, And rather than understanding those as cultural anomaly differences or permutations in the same time period, they are assigned their own time periods, which has an inflationary effect on the number of years that have transpired hitherto now. Now, if you read Herodotus, here are the things. The personality, see, in this expanded work of Herodotus, you have this use of folksy expressions, but these are folksy expressions that were folksy for the people of the medieval period. They weren't folksy expressions for a people who otherwise weren't documented to be existing at that far back in time, independently from the stories that we actually do have of them, which seem to place them only about 1,000 years ago. These are doubly problematic because that's who Herodotus is to us. Now, the expanded work, so you have three Herodotus now. You have the one page that looks super old, and you see Herodotus, and if you look at old Herodotus, and it's from, now there's others that claim to be older, but this is, I'm saying, the oldest in one that we know, we can say that it was not written in the Renaissance. It was clearly written in the 9th or 10th century, in the same way that Photius is clearly from the 9th or 10th century, and he's probably accurately placed there, you see, where he's using Greek, right, at that time, that's probably the same type of Greek used by Charlemagne when he was speaking to Greek religious authorities. The Christian religious authorities in France at the time spoke Greek in the 9th century. Now, it's problematic, in my view, that that in the expanded work, so again, there's the one page, 9th century. There's eight additional pages that are clearly medieval, 11th, 12th century. Now, then there's an expanded history of Herodotus, which everyone with a history degree thinks that that's the Herodotus that was written in several hundred years BC. But the expanded work of Herodotus is a 15th century Italian forgery. It was written by the infamous forger and late Renaissance humanist Lorenzo Valla, who we mentioned before. Now, Lorenzo Valla was a court historian for the Piccolomini family. And the Piccolomini family is a very important family at this time because they had one of their people as the Pope in Rome, I believe. We're going to take a short break for to hear a word from our commercial sponsor, and we'll be back in about 2 minutes, and we're going to dig into exposing how most of we understand in history is a lie. Most of the events that are said to have occurred over the past, let's say, 2,800 years have probably just taken place in the last 1,200 years, which means that there's been a lot of things that we think are patterns in history, and we say, oh, history repeats, and it actually just only happened once the first time, and it was quite a bit more recently than we thought. We'll be back in just a bit. All right, and we're back. We are back. We're back. We're talking about problems in history. Name of this one is Tartaria and Chronology. We haven't even gotten into understanding Tartaria yet, because so far we're just talking about the imperial hubris and the how the empire constructed the collective West, Western Europe. Basically, I mean, there's sort of several approaches why this happened. Just to summarize before we get back granular, there was the loss of Rome to the forces of Mehmet II in 1453 at Constantinople. And this was the creation of talking about the Western tradition. So the Western tradition was born out of the loss of Rome. Today we call it Constantinople, but at the time it was called Rome. The establishment of Second Rome in Italy, subsequent to the Trojan War, which occurs like in 1204 or something like that AD in actuality. So, Rome in Italy as a large capital is created like about 800 years ago and not 800 BC, if that makes sense. Okay. And, what we, let's see. Yes, we were talking about Lorenzo Valla and how the a process, we're talking about the different processes by which history got expanded. So first was a large cultural need to appropriate for Italy a lot of the things that were Greek. Now, you kind of know these things already in a sense, like the religion and the thing and the architecture and the many things. And it's like everything except the language of the Romans comes from the Greeks, right? And likewise, I mean, you have, for example, Thucydides, who says that looking at them, you know, the Greeks and the Persians don't look any different from each other. It's you have to, when you hear them speaking, is when you can tell them apart. That's a very big statement to make, because it explodes the art movement rendering of all of our concepts of what these cultures and people look like. Of course, when we put it farther back in time, there's also a greater chance, maybe, that they would resemble each other less, you know. But when these events were actually happening, because these things were actually being documented from 800 years ago, 1400 years ago, but not from 2000 years ago, you know, etc. You have that. So the Lorenzo Valla was a court historian. And we talked about this at the top of the last hour, the problem of court historians. Now, the Piccolomini family were very powerful. One of their members was the Pope at the time, if I recall correctly. Piccolomini is a funny name because it means little small or little mini. It's like saying small twice. It's very interesting. Piccolomini. And when that family encountered another family of stature, and a claim over disputed fiefs would arise, so they are arguing over these lands. Of course, you can have, well, we had like in the history of Italy with the Guelphi and Ghibellini. Ghibellini and Guelphi fought each other. I think some were closer to the Pope politically and some were closer to the Germans politically, but they fought. People would know very much maybe in, you know, the fair city of Verona with Romeo and Juliet fictional, but their families, remember. Now, you could have open warfare between these families, and you could have war between cities, and it looked like you could have wars between city-states, you know. The main idea being that many would agree often, and especially at this time, that an inopportune war should be avoided. And many wars are inopportune for a number of reasons, and it would be better if you could just resolve these things in the courts. But the same things are on the line, you know, the same stakes, very high stakes game we're talking about, whole swaths of land, okay? Now, when the Piccolomini family would encounter another one of these families, they would have to argue these in a court before a magistrate, okay? So Lorenzo Valla would be hired. He would discover, right, quote-unquote discover, documents that were allegedly hundreds of years old, which inserted another, like, patriarch or two into the Piccolomini family line going back in history, okay, on that land. So in other words, family, let's say, another family would say, oh, we've been on this land since for 500 years. So we hired this family historian, just like they hired the artists to paint the family, they would hire historians to do the genealogy, and just like they would make people look a little bit more attractive in the paintings, they would make them have owned a little bit more land, been a little bit more cousins, they might claim on their family tree that some other people with same surnames, but maybe unrelated as far as they knew, they were actually related in a subordinate way, so that the lands that they are supposed to inherit to their kids should instead go to the other family by the same name. These are the kinds of games that people would play in the courts in Italy all the time, okay, during this time through the medieval and Renaissance period, okay? Now, this process, when you repeat it a few times, added, you know, just by this process happening twice would add 100 years to Italian history, okay? Many families did this, all had their own court historians, their Renaissance Italian history, okay? And what our understanding of history in the West is little more than the vanity project of the ruling class of a single country in Europe from 500 years ago. And now we think that we live in 2022 as a consequence. The effect of this being that numerous events believed to have taken place in the 16th century may have occurred, you know, all other things being equal, and we're not saying that they are. We're saying that just by this process alone, of a few families doing this a couple of times, okay, in a convincing way, could extend the time out of time, because there are still parameters of what occurs prior to these families. So they still have a time and a genealogy to account for, independent of these family members that they keep inserting. Anyway, the entire work of Herodotus, okay, get this, okay? The entire work of Herodotus was actually ordered to be put together by the Piccolomini family based on fiction, okay, besides that one page, that 900 AD, the front single page, okay? This was written by the Photius, all right? Now, incidentally, because we talk of this is, so then who was Photius, right? Incidentally, these are big problem issues, by the way. Photius was also known as Photos I, okay? And was the emperor of a duarchy, of a diarchy, or a synarchy, that ruled for some time in Rome, when in Constantinople. He was called Khazar-faced, and was said to be of Armenian extraction, as were a number of other Roman emperors, incidentally, like quite an unusually high, like unrealistically high number of Roman emperors are Armenian. Too far, not just emperors, but intermarried on too many levels of Italian society for too long and too deeply, considering the conventional history. We would propose instead that many of the lands of Western Europe, that new populations came from the East. All of this is, by the way, mainstream. We're just kind of highlighting what this means, right? Like, if the Franks, even though we say France is named after the Franks, and we say the Franks are a Germanic tribe, but then we say the Germanic tribes don't come from Italy, right? They say the Germanic tribes come from the East. So the Visigoths, the Ostrogoths invaded into Europe. So Germany is not, you know, Germany is named such by people from the East who conquered it. You know, just in terms of taxonomy or the foundation of words, you have like Germany, Armenia are very related words. It's practically the same word. Yetimensky. It's also in Latin or like Spanish, you have hermano, Herman, or the name Herman or Herman, means brother or of a tribe, like of the same tribe. Could also mean like people. Anyway, Yarmen, Armen, the relationships here are a subject for another time. But this goes very deep because you basically have an Armenian who was a co-emperor of Rome when at the location of what we call Constantinople, okay? And that's who wrote Herodotus, the oldest one that we have that's called, I mean, we say there was a historian named Herodotus because we have a document that says Herodotus at the top, as if it was written by a five-year-old who read your name at the top, okay? It's real weird. By the way, just how it was written, there's a space between the words hero and dotus, as if they're two words, like hero and dotus are two words. It's just strange. Now, when we look at the these additional pages that are interdependently established to be from the 11th to 12th centuries, okay, or during the period from the First through Third Crusades, okay, taken together, if we add this all up, okay, with a real lack of any account of a person named Herodotus, okay, before the 10th century AD, right, this relates to the proposition that the that generally, like overall, the Peloponnesian Wars were a theater of the medieval Crusades. In the manner typifying the Renaissance humanist methodology, that is, you know, very typical what we've been examining at length here, Byzantine works from two centuries prior were translated from, I say Byzantine, like, you know, to clarify that you're talking about the medieval Roman, the medieval Romans of the Balkans and Greece, okay? So we just say Byzantine sometimes, to say the medieval Romans of the Balkans and Greece. That most of these things were Greek, Roman, of the Balkans and Greece. And they were translated into Latin or in any of the Italian dialects that were rising at the time. Of course, you know, you had Dante Inferno, which sort of typified the Tuscan dialect as one of the prestige or the predominant prestige dialect, at least in northern, north central Italy, right, at the time. Forgive me if my history isn't as strong as some or yours might be, but I'm just, but you know, some of this I have to piece together from things I haven't looked at in any number of decades, but and explain it to you now. But as an aside, okay, this also adds to a separate discourse about the degree by which medieval Roman, i.e. Byzantine history, was appropriated and then localized by Italians and given an earlier chronological footing. So in other words, a lot of the ancient history of Italy was just taken, but you know, you have a lot of people leaving in 1453 from Constantinople, right? Because it's under siege. And then it's finally taken by Mehmet II, okay? And so a lot of those historians and people with libraries, they left, okay? And they go, and now they are in Venice, arriving, you know, in the ports, and then in Italy, right? Now, then you have the Renaissance start. From all of this Greek knowledge that's being discovered, so the narrative isn't wrong. Yes, there are a lot of highly literate people in northern Italy at this time who are getting their hands on, you know, quote unquote lost or ancient Greek wisdom from centuries ago. Yes, it's true. But it was just a few centuries ago. But it's a few centuries ago prior to the creation of the printing press, et cetera, where a few centuries is like obscured by the winds of time. Do you understand? And so this idea that this was some reestablishment of something was true, both in the geopolitical sense of the loss of Constantinople in 1453 and in terms of appropriating all of this Greek and Persian antiquity, meaning medieval, right? You see, stuff from the 9th century around, you know, very early proto-antiquity, right? Because we're putting the actual dates when we say 9th century around and onwards. And this is ancient. This is stuff that's as old as 600 years. But they don't, there's no dates, there's no stamps on these things. But in reality, this stuff is like 600 years old, some of this stuff. A lot of the stuff, more of this stuff is like 300 years old. But here they have it now, okay? And there they are. And they know that it's old. I mean, right? But they don't know how old. And that's sort of where the problem begins. But they're certainly, and I say they want, sometimes we're talking about the unconscious or collective urgings or the social requirement that gets transmitted through many different people's careers and contracts. There was a need that Italian history be older, that it not be the offshoot or the second fiddle part of a broader thing, that they had lost the real center of it. Now, when I'm saying things still in ways that are not exactly clear, and I understand that. But in terms of the identity of the 1453 and Mehmet II, because, well, we did allude to it, that Mehmet II saw himself, despite, yes, this is where we left off on that note, despite the fact that in 19th century Turkey and the rise of the Young Turks and through a lot of Turkish power institutions during the rise of the Turkification of the Ottoman Empire, when the Ottoman Empire, when it's over this process, both consciously at times even, but mostly unconsciously, subsuming, digesting, and then, but then kind of filtering, and then ultimately removing a lot of these formative things, which are in fact Greek and Persian. That what we call Ottoman is like Greek, Persian, and Kozak, like kind of like Turkic Russians, Kozak, like wild Turkic Russians. And I use all these words in an uncomfortable way in conjoined hyphenations so that people expand their categories, not to insult anybody, okay? I know that there are probably many Turks who would take offense at being considered like a having a common root with some common root of Russians or something, but I think it's actually goes in the opposite direction. I think it lends to the majesty and depth of the question and the people involved. So we have this thing with creating history in Italy is our theme. And we talked about Piccolomini. They have someone who's going to be a pope or is a pope, and they have family in the clergy. Okay, so you have Francesco Todeschini Piccolomini. Here's a funny name too. Francesco Todeschini, okay. Francesco means Frankish, right? And Todeschini or Todeschini means Tudesch or Deutsch, which means German. So they're definitely a Holy Roman family of northern Italy or Germany, a good Latin-speaking German family, right, as many were. German was the Vulgate language in the German lands, but the ruling class spoke Greek and Latin. Cardinal Frankish-German Piccolomini, which means double small or small, small, small. Now, if it was Piccolomini, it could be like Magni, it could be like a corruption of big, like Magna, but I'm pretty sure this is Piccolomini, like small, small. Required that his job, right, was to establish to establish his family, including his nephew and others, as a very wealthy, powerful family on the lands of Italy going back a long, long time. In reality, a lot of these people had arrived into the lands of Italy and Greece more recently, whether they were like Romanian, like Balkan, whether they were like we were saying Greek, Romans of the Balkans and Greece, whether there was the Persian and Roman empires were actually very merged in many ways. I don't want to digress into different constructs of thinking about civil wars versus actual wars between cultures. Some of these Roman civil wars are portrayed correctly as civil wars, but then in the medieval iterations of those, they take on these weird cultural dimensions. This has to do with the way that the agreement was made to divide history thematically between ecclesiastical history, secular history, the humanist version of history, and the idealist version of antiquity history, including the interaction of the gods, which is like a pagan version of magical realism in history. So these were the multiple trends in the intellectual development of Renaissance Italy. And instead of having to arrive at a single version of history, they gave each of these intellectual movements their own historical period, which which we're going to explain in detail. Now, the work, one of the things that Piccolomini, the Cardinal Piccolomini, did was establish Lorenzo Valla as a real historian, right? So that other of Valla's claims necessary to the Piccolomini family of its time, right, would be considered legitimate in the eyes of the ruling magistrate. So Piccolomini, wow, you discovered Herodotus, right? Oh, wow, look at, it was written by this guy, Photius, whatever, some version of it. But wow, you have the expanded version. Like, no one has this. You have such an expanded version of Herodotus, and now Herodotus is writing in vernacular, in the, you know, here's a, he's writing, he's saying expressions that only make sense, like, to inventions of like farming equipment not even in existence until the year, you know, 1000 or something like that. You see, like, certain expressions and things that just didn't exist at the time. Okay. So that was very important. So they introduced him like he's a very important scholar. And you see them do that today with scholars and stuff, again, especially with the, you know, mandatory injections and the gene therapy. You can see how they build people up like they're an expert. And then all of a sudden you see why they're building them up as an expert, right? One of the things that they had to do was to there was this significant push to lengthen the look and feel of Italian history itself in connection with the fictionalized Roman Empire of this Italic peninsula. The earliest, by the way, Italic meaning like a border, could mean like border, like the edge. Why would Italy be the edge of something? Why would Italia be the edge of it? Why would it be the border? But it could also be Italic as in liner or ruler. You know, one cannot help but see some kind of something between the words Attila, who's very important there, and Italia. But anyway, therefore, for example, maybe Attila the Hun is just another way of saying like the Khan of the Huns, not like a guy named Attila, but just like saying like the Hunnic Khan. Anyway, the work of Valla was so important that it was then, after being built up by Cardinal Piccolomini, okay, then he gets promoted to like a bigger role of history, like writing history of Italy, by Pope Pius II. However, Pope Pius II was just the uncle of Cardinal Piccolomini. He was just, Pope Pius II was actually Pope Piccolomini. Okay, now we just focused on the issue of Herodotus, not because it is unique, but because it is typical. The problems in Strabo, the other problems in Photius, there's problems in all of it. There's problems from the ground up, there's problems. Okay. We will develop this in the future. We just wanted to introduce where some of the problems kind of originated from. We have more to develop where the problem originated from, and we wouldn't have even gotten to the distortions of Russian history. Why does Russian history only start 800 or 900 AD? At the same time, so officially Russian history only starts like around 800 or 900 AD, officially. Why? Well, because they're probably, with some more accuracy, dating old things. But if they use the same rules that they apply to Western Europe, okay, and they look at things from written in, I'm just going to guess, like, that are older than Old Church Slavonic, maybe, right? Because it would be before Cyril and Methodius developed the system in the 9th century in Salon, right? So it probably would have been like in Glottolitic, I'm going to assume, or like in runes, like something between Glottolitic and runes, like a runic Glottolitic, I would say, yes. So you have this old stuff, but by the same standards, you would say, oh, when you see the stuff from Italy that's written in like Proto-Latin, it's kind of like Glottolitic, isn't it? It's very much rune style as well. It's very similar to, let's say, the Etruscan style of writing. Okay, then all of a sudden you're in fucking 600 BC. You see the problem I'm having? So they maintain that there's like these writing styles that were in use for several thousand years, that so that when one people use that style, they can say, well, that was at this end of the 2,000 years. Well, that's all of history, bro. You can't say that writing has evolved and then say, you know, they just play fast and loose with this. It's true that things can move along these coordinates, and there's multiple variables here. That's true. But they just fit them always conveniently. I'm just remembering, they just made me think now, because there's the Bulgarian Tsar, I think, Simeon of the so-called Second Bulgarian Empire. I mean, of course, we would say there's just been one. It was actually a type of Roman Empire of a Bulgarian line, but again, there's the same thing with Serbian history. They just completely changed the definitions of what these things meant, or how you would think about them in terms of time, space, power, as if the Bulgarian Tsar didn't have a seat on a throne in Constantinople. Like, what a dumb idea, right? So not to be confused with the mayor of Constantinople, right? Just a dumb idea. Just how they talk about the medieval period is so stupid. But at least we have good evidence there, because this czar was also a scholar, and he did a study of the type of writing that the Bulgarians used prior to the introduction, the writing style that had been used in Bulgaria prior to the introduction of Cyrillic by the monks Cyril and Methodius, which also is questionable, but we won't get into that. But just to say that it's true that, you know, that Cyrillic comes after the thing that came before it. It's just, you know, that's true. But what he was saying, what he wrote under a pseudonym, this Bulgarian Tsar, I think Simeon, wrote under a pseudonym that the type of writing that was used in Bulgaria prior to Cyrillic was actually, what's it called? I'm having a senior moment. It's the strokes and dots. Cuneiform. Cuneiform was the style. Anyway, this would have been more consistent with the Persian occupation of the Balkans that actually continued indefinitely. Our sense of political forms and titles and names of things is fluid. History is a cultural product of the present. There is no objective existence called the past. It's a construct of the mind. Everything of that you can think of the existence of the past exists in the moment of the present. The evidence of the past is far to extend beyond that there is a existence of the moment in the present that you're experiencing. Going back farther in time becomes more guesswork. But the dates in which certain events occurred is more or less probable to have occurred otherwise than what we're, you know, conventionally told. Yeah. So next time we talk about this, we're going to talk more about the, how it got to be the, Tartaria, then the need to eliminate and change history of Tartaria. This relates very much to the origins of some aspects of European history, which the sacking of Constantinople in 1453 and the creation of the Western tradition, right, in the aftermath of that, and then the how the Renaissance develops, you know, concurrently with that and based upon the, like you could say, refugees, et cetera, we would then be looking at how history itself, the distortions that we see in history are based upon the value systems that were then present. So if we say that our history, so in other words, we know that when we do history, that we're actually, it's a reflection of our own value systems and our own selves that we're projecting that into the past. Okay. But likewise, the history that was believed by people in the past, and now we're doing history on history, is also similar to them. So when we look at how people in the Renaissance understood the past, what we're understanding is the people in the Renaissance. Okay, we're not really understanding the past. That's why when we are attacking or critiquing or deconstructing what gets called history, we have to look first to these people during the late Renaissance. Okay, all right, very good. So we'll probably be at this particular subject like in 2 days. We'll come back to it because we have a lot more on. Actually, we could go on, you know, indefinitely on it. I've got thousands of hours on this, but yeah, this is just a 1% of 1% of it. All right, I'm out.